welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Majidou. We're going to be Ericless today, but we're still going to have fun anyway, and Eric's going to be back in a couple weeks, so it's all good. Today, we're going to be having a little conversation about religion, everybody's favorite topic. And, you know, right now, I know this is going to sound like something maybe everybody says all the time, but it's so crazy right now. There are so many revolutions in, I mean, pick which country you want to. Like, over the past year, there's been that energy of revolution has been pretty predominant just about everywhere. And at the same time, there are a lot of these political revolutions going on. And like I said, name whatever spot you want, and it's probably there. There's also a lot of religious revolutions happening right now at this time. And when I say that, I mean like on kind of big levels, right? We had the Pope situation happening over there, you know, with the Pope resigning. That was revolutionary and hadn't happened for quite a while. And then this new Pope is doing all kinds of different things and kind of stirring stuff up. And the way people approach Catholicism is going through pretty substantial alterations. And we're seeing these changes in the way people view their religion going through a lot of shifts. And I've always been interested in seeing how people can, for hundreds of years, have a belief system or a paradigm or a government, all the same thing, right? And then to have it experience a pretty radical shift and what results from that. So today we're going to be talking about the shifts that can happen and how people's kind of beliefs or religions or systems can change, how to break out of paradigms and then have more experiences. And we're very lucky to be joined today by my friend Gabriel Roberts. He wrote a book called Born Again to Rebirth, which talks about his own personal experience of going through this shift and kind of what happened to him. And I feel like these individual stories are so important because it really reflects, like, how does this happen on larger levels, on societal levels, on the Catholic Church level? You know, that can't happen unless it happens in some individual first. So we're going to be getting into that a little bit today. And so we'll just introduce Gabriel. Gabriel, are you there? How's it going?
I am here and I'm doing well.
All right. Good to hear. So before we get started on the philosophy, you know, I didn't notice, I was reading some parts in your book, and you were born in Tacoma and grew up in Seattle?
That's right.
Dude, I'm totally from Seattle as well. I'm from a little island. Vashon Island is where I went to high school and then lived in the Seattle area for years until I moved down to L.A.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. It's funny because, you know, when we bump into each other, there have been these weird synchronicities where our courses have bumped up against each other. It's quite interesting.
I know. It's so good. I love it when that happens. But so you were born up in the Northwest and then were raised in a pretty religious kind of upbringing, right? I mean, what exactly what environment were you brought up in?
So my dad grew up Mormon, and he lived in Eastern Washington, which is a lot more provincial than even what, you know, Tacoma and Seattle might be considered. And then he kind of became a hippie for a while and whatnot. And then he met my mother, who had grown up Lutheran, and somehow out of a Mormon and a Lutheran, they decided that they really wanted to be Pentecostal evangelical Christians. So they joined the Assemblies of God Church called Life Center in Tacoma. It's a rather large church. It was one of the first mega churches in the country, actually. And so I kind of got in on this kind of one of the more mystical versions of Christianity, still heavily fundamentalist as far as the view of the scriptures concerned, the earth being 6,000 years old, et cetera, et cetera. And that's what I went for. My mom loved watching Jimmy Swaggart preach sermons on television when I was a little kid. I would, like, get up with a Bible and start screaming at everyone, just like he did. And so it was all, that was kind of the thing that I thought was supposed to happen. But from my perspective, the world stage was already set. The story was already understood, you know, from a very, very young age. At least that's the way I saw the world. And it continued to be that way until my late 20s.
Wow. And so, I mean, so that really kind of established a literal paradigm in your brain. And did you have, like, until you were in your 20s, there was no kind of, like, questioning or, you know, tumult that you went through with it? It was just very much accepted and kind of like, you know, that was the deal?
Yeah, for the most part, it was this is the paradigm that I'm working in, and I'm going to work it the very best I can. Be as devout as possible. I went on missionary trips in my preteens and in my teen years. When I got out of high school, I started going to Bible college to learn about, you know, the Bible and all of this other stuff. And in that, it seemed like it was all groovy. And a lot of things that, it's funny how you may look at something for years and years and years, and then it doesn't dawn on you the error that you might find in it later on. And then after that, you're like, oh, wow, how did I ever think that that was something possible, that that was the thing, that was awesome? How did that happen?
Right. It is, and that it's so, that I believe is a human condition, you know, that it's not, I think it happens so in so many different cases that you just have to kind of chalk it up to a human brain issue, you know, that's kind of in us. But can you, for folks that may not be familiar, can you just cite maybe like a quickie, what were the kind of like main tenets of your Pentecostal beliefs? If you could like break it down to like kind of, you know, five main things people know, like kind of what the deal was in your
I'll try to do that. So let's see. I can do this really quickly. God created mankind because he was lonely and he wanted to express love. God was definitely a he. Adam and Eve goofed up because there was one tree out of all the trees in the whole world that were all really delicious and wonderful, and they had to go pick the one that was not allowed. They were fooled by the serpent, which was Lucifer, which was the highest angel, the most beautiful, most wonderful angel, and he came in the form of a serpent, tricked them, and said, the God that you serve is a jerk face. And then they went ahead and ate this fruit, and because of that, they were thrown out of the Garden of Eden. And ever since then, it was the fall of man, and because man and woman had sinned against God in doing this, they were forced to work. Work was something that you had to do because of something somebody else did a long time ago. Women having their period was the curse. It was a curse from God that they had to go through pain and child labor, and that they had to bleed every month, and so on and so forth. That the Old Testament, going through all of these things, were all foresights and foreshadowings of the coming Messiah, of the coming Christ. The story where Abraham is going to sacrifice his son. It is said that the same place where Abraham was going to sacrifice his son is the same place where in Golgotha, where Christ was crucified, representing the there was a ram caught in the thicket, and God basically provided a propitiation, a change, something to take on the sins of your own stuff. So there's this ongoing theme that occurs.
Right, the scapegoat.
Right, the scapegoat, exactly. And Jesus was the scapegoat for all of humanity. Jesus was born of a virgin and went along his life being really awesome and radical and telling the powers that be what's what. One of my favorite things that Jesus said about the ruling religious authority was that they were like whitewashed sepulchers, that that essentially on the outside they looked so beautiful, but on the inside they were full of dead men's bones. And I thought that was a really metal thing to say. But basically, then Jesus died on the cross being a perfect human being. He was perfect and spotless. He never did anything wrong. He was pious and did all these miracles to prove that he was the Son of God, the one and only Son of God. And now all of us who are graced enough to hear the story, all we have to do to accept this grace of God and go to heaven is to accept Jesus into our heart, to say, Jesus, come into my life, and you're my God now. And that fixes everything. So for instance, the extreme story would be if Hitler on his dying deathbed asked Jesus into his heart, all of the horrible atrocities he did would be absolutely forgiven. And Bob's your uncle, Fanny's your aunt, you're in heaven hanging out with Hitler. That would be how it worked. And to me, that was like, all right, that's extreme grace. That's
Well, and so how did that, so that being your story, like how did that affect your life? I mean, you said you went on a lot of missions, so basically it sounds like your life was pretty much geared to telling the story to everybody, right? For the purpose, was it like basically for the purpose of kind of having everybody like to be able to go hang out in heaven with Hitler? Like, was that like the goal?
Right. Because, essentially... Now, looking in retrospect, it's set up kind of like a really, really terrible game. Like a really terrible game that, you know, you can't win. One day I decided to just round up some basic numbers, and I looked up how many people on the earth have ever lived, according to what we know. And it's billions and billions and billions of people. And then I looked up how many people are Christians, even by the loosest term of the word throughout all time, and I compared those two numbers, and it's less, far less than 10%. So that means that no matter what anyone does from here on out, that everyone in the past, 90% of those people who've ever lived, all these wonderful people who were loved and had to go through all this stuff, they're all in hell. Absolutely, they're all in hell burning while Hitler's in heaven.
Right.
So,
that's like the Mormons, right? The Mormons work on posthumous baptism for people, right? Where they'll like take people who, you know, maybe are their relatives, or usually I think they're their relatives. I'm not exactly sure what the rules are, but they will baptize people that are already dead. It maybe been dead for hundreds of years, so to do exactly what you just said, to save them from their existence in hell, since they couldn't like be Christian or whatever, for whatever reason. So they actually do ancestry missionary work.
Totally.
Which is kind of amazing.
It is. It's how different is that from when indulgences were sold by the Catholic Church and things were done so that you could try and get your loved ones out of purgatory. You had to pay money to get them out of purgatory, because we all know that God operates on material wealth. That's how he stays alive.
They sold tickets to heaven, you know. They literally sold, you could buy a ticket to heaven from the Catholic Church. So that was like their deal, you know. But that was your deal. That was your life. Like you were dedicated, you were doing it, you were in it. And then what happened in your 20s that started to kind of like make the cracks show?
Well, there were, you know, several things that occurred. One was that for all of my efforts, for all of my devotion, for all of my giving up material wealth, living poor all the time, spending all my time evangelizing, trying to make things happen that way, for all of that, for all of my seeking with tears and prayer and fasting, whatever I could do to try and get a touch from God, a touch from the divine. It never came. It never came. It wasn't like God was like, "Hey, I'm so happy you've been doing this. You're doing the right thing, Gabe. Here I am. Hi."
You never had a mystic experience where you kind of felt God's presence.
I had many an occasion where in a group setting, I felt the tinglies or things like that. And I was Pentecostal, so, I mean, it was the kind of thing where there was a faith healer coming along, a preacher, and they come whack you on the forehead and you fall over and you're slain
right.
in the spirit, as they say. But I have to admit that the only times that I ever fell over, it was of my own volition, because, you know, when 30 people before you fall over when you're touched, what are you going to do? You know, stand
right.
there and be like, "Nope, I don't feel it, man." So it felt to me like it was ineffectual. If God was around, he wasn't doing the job of being my personal homeboy that I had made. I sat him down in the center of my heart, and I didn't watch porn because he didn't want me to, you know. But then it was like, well, geez, there's got to be some give and take in this relationship here. I mean, it's really hard to, it's like, you know, I made an analogy in the book about a dad who writes this really long, scary letter about how you got to do all this stuff and you're never going to hear from me. But
right.
you can write me letters and you can pray to the wind and I'll hear it. And then I'm going to show up one day, decades from now, and if you didn't do everything that I said, I'm going to set you on fire.
Right.
And so to me, that concept, it was like horrifying. And the other thing, actually in Bible college, one of the things that really was one of the fault lines was that I'm reading in the Greek with a guy, a really old missionary who's been around for, you know, he was in the field for like 50 years down in Mexico. And he talked about Christianity like, "Listen, guys, if this is the truth, then every single thing that is said in here must be abided by." And so we went through like Romans chapter 15, really, really heavy chapter that talks about how essentially God makes vessels for destruction and vessels for filling, meaning we are the vessels, people are vessels. And he actually
right.
literally makes things to be destroyed. He makes people just to be destroyed so that the people who aren't destroyed know how good they have it. And this is of course Calvinism, and it's not accepted by all evangelicals, but it is. John Calvin was one of the reformers, so it was like something to deal with, and you had to do some.
That is something to deal with.
You had to do some doctrinal gymnastics to avoid the idea. But the argument the Apostle Paul said was like, "Yep, he's God; he can do whatever he wants." And you can look in the Old Testament, and this was the excuse that covered up infanticide in Hosea and in 1 Samuel and in Chronicles, where literally God says, "Go slash open the bellies of your pregnant enemies and let the babies come out and kill them. Smash their heads on the ground," like all this wretched stuff. And it was all covered under the God is God and he can do whatever he wants.
Mm.
But after a while, that didn't work for me. That my compassionate side was like, "What? How is this possible? How can it be reconciled with this loving, endlessly perfect God?" And especially after having my own kids, it was impossible for me to imagine doing the scenario in which I send my kids off and I never see them, and then I set them on fire because they didn't do the things that I wanted them to do. It seemed impossible.
Right.
So,
well, and that literally is kind of the breaking point that a lot of people will go through their dark night of the soul, right? It's usually suffering pain and like the existence of purposeful suffering that kind of messes everybody up religiously, right? There was, I mean, C.S. Lewis's great book, The Problem of Pain, kind of addresses that. But the reason why a lot of people lose their faith is just simply because they see terrible things. You know, and they don't understand how, you know, God can allow terrible things to happen. So for you, that was kind of like what started it, right? Was like, hey, why is bad stuff going on kind of thing? Or like even right. The Bible, like how is that happening?
Well, even like doctrinally speaking, we were reading through 1 John. And reading it in the Greek, and there were sections that it talked about how doing something would cover a multitude of sins. But if Jesus Christ was the one and only medium between God and man, and he did all of the work of doing your salvation, then you don't need a couple of sins covered. And yet it was this weird epithet into, oh, yeah, just in case, if you do this thing, you get bonus points. But it's like
right.
It was already covered. So doctrinally speaking, it was like, why is this? Is this like an extra just in case you mess up at the very end of your life? It's like, oh, it's cool. You're fine.
Right.
But then once I questioned the idea of God's infallibility as far as making good decisions and taking care of his children, which is us, when I went back and I read through scriptures that were really harsh, I was like, no, this can't be right. This
right.
can't be right. And I went through, I would say, a couple of years of a progressive fault line opening up where that just nagged at me and nagged at me. And then I would try to do things in the name of God in my own way of understanding that just didn't work, missionary things. And you know, I was in a Christian rock band, and we toured the country, and we played all these shows, and nothing was working. We didn't get picked up. We didn't get signed, whatever, you know, that means for people in the music industry. But it was like, okay, well, what do I do now? And so when I went back, I did my first 3 years of college all in one clump. And then there was a 6-year gap between when I first started and when I came back. And in my last year, I hadn't come out yet as a non-Christian because I wanted to finish my degree.
You hadn't come out of the non-Christian closet.
Right. And at the time I was married to my young wife. I married her when she was 19 and I was 21. And
so you were in the thick of an entire community that all had these beliefs, and then you were independently having these thoughts and feelings. Were you talking to other people? You
no, couldn't. No, I wasn't talking with
else.
Other people about it.
Yeah.
I didn't talk with other people about it because
they were all in the Christian boat, right?
Gung-ho, man. I mean, yeah. It's kind of like, if you think of it from their perspective, it was like, Jesus saved you. What more do you want? Live a miserable life. It doesn't matter. Jesus saved you.
Right.
Go through pain and suffering and deal with bad relationships because Jesus saved you. And whatever you do now, I mean, it's written there in the New Testament that the Apostle Paul says, I am a slave to Christ. It is not I who lives, but Christ that lives within me. That means that your stuff doesn't matter. Your own feelings don't matter. None of that stuff matters. You are a
right.
slave to Christ. And although Jesus says, I don't call you a slave, I call you a friend, it goes back and forth like, yes, you're not a slave, but you should behave like you're a slave.
Right.
Like, you're saved by grace through faith, so you could technically go do whatever you want, but you shouldn't, because the fact that you would do that means that you don't actually believe it. It's like,
well,
this,
so you were not raised in an environment or existed in an environment where it was cool to like call these kind of things into question, right? Because even, I mean, was it okay to question them, or you couldn't even like say like, hey, what's this about? Or everybody just kind of like would be like, you know, even if it wasn't cool with them, they wouldn't say anything.
I think that there's some mechanism in ourselves that wants really bad for things to be so, or or if you believe that the world is a particular way, it does not matter if there's some messed up things about it. That's the way the world is. And to me, that was it. Some people were born to go to hell, and I'm thankful that it wasn't me. That was all I could really say about it. And because I never, I started from childhood. I mean, unquestioning. You tell a child something with surety, and they believe you. And so I kept going with that for as long as it would last. But then common sense and reason. I mean, there was a, it sounds so silly, but there was a weekly magazine called The Stranger in Seattle. And they have hilarious articles, and they're very progressive. And they would say stuff that I related to and quietly was, like, chuckling to myself about. But I couldn't say I agreed with it. I had to, like, do this sort of strange posturing so that I wouldn't appear like I was really into being okay with gay people or being okay with drug use or alcohol or anything like that. So,
what happened when the bubble popped? I mean, so here you are, you're kind of having all these feelings and thoughts very much to yourself, and then, I mean, what did you just have, like a mega eruption where you just left the community? How did you kind of like shift? How did you make the change?
I did it up really big. What I did was I split up with my wife. And I left Christianity at exactly the same time, a couple weeks after I graduated from Bible college with my degree in theology. And then I was 27. I started dating a 19-year-old girl fresh out of rehab who, with good speed, got me into the drug culture. And I spent the next about year and a half in, like, this total void of debauchery. In many ways, it was kind of like the things I should have been experimenting with when I was 19 or 20. I was like playing catch up, I suppose, with the hedonistic way of doing things. And I knew what was going to happen when the shit hit the fan. I knew that everyone was going to hate me. And lo and behold, they hated me. And it was awful. Family rejected me. Friends rejected me. Imagine building 27 years of relationships and counting all but five people as enemies now. Like, everything you ever worked for, totally gone. And so I was in a bad spot. I was emotionally distraught because, my young wife and I had built a relationship upon our devotion to Christ. Without my devotion to Christ, it was like we had nothing to talk about. And so we didn't. We didn't talk. We didn't touch. We didn't do anything for, like, the last year of the relationship. And it was like, wow, this thing's dead. My faith's dead. Everything's dead. I got to try to find some new way to live my life. And it didn't go to
So your whole identity, was tied into just serving Jesus, right?
So I didn't know who I was. And I went on this journey of trying to find myself, which, of course, you know, I'm still on now, but I have a lot more sure footing after some good perspective. But, for a while I just said, well, I guess I believe in science now. That's nice. I can
have that now work for you.
Now I can agree that the world is probably older than 6,000 years old. I can be okay with dinosaurs and homosexuals and drinking or whatever. So that was great. That was reassuring. I found out that there's a lot of cool stuff there. I mean, I tried my very first psychedelics. I ate a handful of mushrooms, and it was really great. And I was like, wow, what is this all about? And I started the long process of learning about what other religions really are talking about.
So this is the first time in your life you had even, like, looked at books from other religions.
Yeah, and I didn't read anything that was non-Christian until probably 25 or 26. In my last year of school, I read, I think it's called the Sri Upanishad and the Bhagavad Gita, which was given to me by some Hare Krishnas on the street. I read through that, and I found some inspirational things there. I started reading about Buddhism. One of the girls I dated was a Hindu, so I learned some of those things. But I was so burnt out on trying to make the religion thing work that I
right.
just said screw it to all of it. I didn't want to deal with it for a long time. And because of that, I just tried to focus on recovering my own self-image. But then it kind of went through this process of me trying to prove something to all of the people that I had let down, that I wasn't just this reprehensible human being bound for hell. Like, if I could somehow become a big business success, then I could prove that. Of course, over time, I realized that that was foolish as well, and that it's totally okay to be me, whether I'm super duper rich and successful, or whether I'm living as a pauper or a hippie or something.
Well, and
whatever.
Did you have like residuals still that you were going to go to hell for what was happening, or had you pretty much like felt good about eradicating that sort of thought from your brain, or were you still feeling guilt and shame for your behavior?
I was feeling guilt and shame on the level of my own personal feelings about myself. It wasn't any longer about God, because I realized, okay, if this is incorrect, then I don't need to worry about it. And so I didn't. I said, okay, well, it's obviously incorrect. The story that I'm told is incorrect. There's, you know, flaming dragons and angels falling from the sky and all these crazy things going on and people slaughtering each other, and okay, this is ridiculous. But then there was the inkling that there was something to it, which now in my present studies, I've spent the last couple of years going through the gauntlet of book after book, probably reading about a book a week in all kinds of backgrounds, primarily in like shamanism and things like that, but reading Joseph Campbell and Terrence McKenna and even like magic people like Peter J. Carroll and stuff like that. So I've gotten through a lot of other stuff. I've also had a lot of psychedelic experiences that have really changed my perspective and honestly gave me my very first touch of the divine of like, oh my gosh, there is something on the other side.
Well,
there's
so
someone
that's
there.
That's what I want to ask you about next, is that so you had come into that feeling of futility with, you know, not feeling anything. So that's an important little sticker. But first, we're going to take a little break. We're going to have a few words from the Progressive Radio Network, and we're going to get into that dilemma of being able to have a personal experience when we get back. Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou, and we're here talking with Gabriel Roberts. He's the author of Born Again to Rebirth. And we're talking about losing religion and finding religion and going through breakthroughs and changing consciousness and kind of shifting paradigms. So before the break, Gabriel, you were mentioning how you started to finally, after leaving your religion, started having mystical experiences. So I mean, theoretically, you'd think that why anyone would practice any religion would be specifically to have those experiences. So for you, though, that didn't happen until after you kind of just, like, got rid of all of it. And then was there a moment, like a significant moment when you had like your first experience that you can just really kind of pinpoint, or was it more of like a general thing?
There were a few key moments, and they were kind of like a build up on a bell curve. I went to a Ziggy Marley concert, and I smoked some cannabis before it with my girlfriend, and when we went there, I got into the groove. I started listening to it, right then and there, there were hundreds and hundreds of people in the concert hall at the Showbox in Seattle. And all of a sudden, I felt the Holy Spirit. I felt the same feeling that I felt on Sunday morning in church when everyone was obviously giving their all in devotion to something. And I felt it, and I was like, oh my goodness, it's not just Pentecostalism. It's not just Jesus that does this. This is a thing that people do. This is a thing that people generate. And that blew my mind. It really blew my mind. But it wasn't until much later on that I, for as far as mystical experiences occurred, this is going to be somewhat embarrassing and interesting, I suppose. But when Ancient Aliens first came out, they had some amazing things to say.
Right.
You know, it's like everything, you got to take things with a grain of salt, but there are some major mysteries out there in the world, and especially in the ancient world. And when I was exposed to writers like David Wilcock, who put out a book called The Source Field Investigations, and again, sometimes it's grain of salt, but a lot of it is like he was citing Rupert Sheldrake and a bunch of other scientists who are doing these things that he was talking about. Changes in DNA and so on and so forth, and like experiments with these Italian wall lizards and this little island that evolved over 30 years because their situation had changed and they had to change in order to live. And they actually had a marked change in their DNA when this happened. And so there are all these weird, exciting things going on. But that got me into something that I had sneakily already loved and was interested in, and that was the occult.
Right.
Just interesting things like Aleister Crowley. Like, who was he? What was he really about? Why was he such a naughty bastard? What
right.
was going
so,
on?
So at this
month?
Point, after you went to the Ziggy Marley concert, was that your doorway into the occult, right?
I think that experience and my experience with the drug culture, there was one day that I hope to never replicate where I tried every drug that was available to me in a 48-hour period of time, where it was like uppers and downers and ecstasy and cocaine and marijuana and mushrooms and anything I could get my hands on. All in this one period of time, I ended it with like a bunch of Adderall, and I had to go work at the end of it. But there was something about that heightened state that I didn't know its name. I didn't know what its purpose was. But going through that, it was like I was having a bunch of experiences that I didn't understand, a bunch of things that no one had explained to me. And because I wasn't looking through any kind of religious eyeglass or filter, I didn't know what to call it, what to name it, if there was any relevance to it at all, or if it was just a change in our chemistry that made life interesting from time to time. So when I finally got around to, I started picking up books by the people who showed up on Ancient Aliens. Graham Hancock was in the first season a bunch. And so I read some of his work. I read a book of his called Supernatural, in which he talks about these cave paintings from that are dated to be 50,000 years old that have hypnagogic patterns all over the place. And then he talked about taking iboga and about his experience with his father's passing and trying to reach out to his father through the use of iboga in the afterlife, trying to get a hold of him, and his experiences with ayahuasca. And then this opened up the gateway of learning about shamanism. And the funny thing, which I believe was my own prediction, I said all the time as a Christian, I said, if Christianity is not the true religion, then the real thing must be the oldest thing that we've ever done. And it turns out that would be shamanism. And shamanism,
right.
of course, goes through, has a unified theme throughout the world. There's unified practices, ecstatic states that don't require psychedelics, meditation, so on and so forth. And so I continued kind of down that path, and I started reading Helena Blavatsky's book, Isis Unveiled, which to me was this
profound trouncing of Christianity from 150 odd years ago.
How did your like old Christian brain relate to this material? Did you see like parallels that you went back to, or did you find it was just all new and kind of like revolutionary to your brain, or were you able to kind of like make connections? What was like the feeling behind that experience?
Well, for instance, Helena Blavatsky was famous for talking about the secret doctrine. And as a good Christian apologist and as a minister, I knew about what they talked about. And
right.
I knew that, for instance, they claimed that there was a unified theme among all mankind, that there was some sort of unified spiritual practice. And so I kind of followed through with that and began to just read on and on and on about shamanism. And I found myself really wanting to have that experience myself. And I don't necessarily advocate it for everyone, but I had a tremendous experience with DMT, which is the primary, it's in your mind, it's manufactured by your pineal gland, and it's what neuroscientists believe causes you to dream. So it's this very important part of our human physiology. It happens to be all over the place. So I found a way to consume it, and holy Moses, I was out of my body, talking to transdimensional beings, and they were really excited to see me, and it felt like I had known them forever, like they were my best friends. And they were like, all right, we got to start doing the work. You got to start doing the work now. You got to go do your thing now. And I'm like, what is this? And I realized that everything that I had gone through, all the Christianity stuff, that was like a really big boot camp, and that I was still a minister. But now I was a minister in the traditional way. Like
so
I
it started
become,
kind of taking on a different form.
I had become a shaman in my own way, and I'm not saying that to toot my own horn. It's not like I can heal people at will or anything like that, but it is what I have become. I've
right.
become a magician in that way. And because of all of that stuff, everything came back to me like, oh, I get it now. And then I look back at Jesus's work and even the work of all of the Jews in the Old Testament. I'm like, these guys are all magicians. They're all shamans. They're all doing some crazy magic stuff. Well, then that brought me to like be really, really excited about life again and about God, and especially after my DMT experience, I was like, you know what? I don't need to worry about who God is. Like, I know what I need to do now. It became this thing where it was like non-religious, where the dogma wasn't there. And then I started reading, people like Peter J. Carroll, who wrote, who's one of the founders of Chaos Magic. He described using belief as a tool, as a thought form. You don't necessarily have to believe in Zeus all the time, but when you need some Zeus juju, you can, like, tap into Zeus. And,
right.
and after that, I understood how it didn't matter what religion you were. You could get something out of that religion. But I've explained it to other people, like, you can get juice out of a glass using a coffee stir stick straw with the tiny little holes. You can drink juice through that straw, but why not just take the straw out and drink it whole, right?
Right.
Or use a bigger straw. And it seems like there are many systems, all systems around the world have their saints, their matriarchs and patriarchs, who have shown that you can do something amazing with this particular system. But by excluding all others, they limit themselves as far as the breadth of perspective that is required in order for you to really get the most out of this life.
Well, do you feel like you ever would have reached that level of understanding through the Pentecostal church? Like, do you think that's possible to do it through that system? Or do you feel like, then, in your experience, do you feel like it's necessary to break out and try and have a more comprehensive experience?
I can say that I did everything I possibly could to, within that system, see God, see anything
right.
at all. And nothing occurred. The only occurrences I ever had that were spiritual were what I classically would call demonic in nature. When I was a child, I had horrific nightmares all the time. That scary things, like really bad, scary things, trying to get me, trying to steal my soul. When I told someone for the first time, I'm going to Bible college, I had this vision of this like demonic creature, this gigantic man that was covered in like bloody red meat musculature, like grabbing my guts and trying to tear my guts out. And I woke. And this is the only like spiritual experience I had. When I woke, it was still happening. It was like it was trying to tear my guts out, and I cried out to Jesus, and it went away. And at the time, I thought, oh, well, that means that the devil doesn't want me to go to Bible college, so I should go to Bible college.
Right.
Now, having read about shamanism, one of the things that happens during a rite of passage is that you're torn apart, and then you're put back together.
It's the dismemberment that happens.
Right, and so seeing that was like a whole new perspective to it. But getting back to your question, I don't think that Pentecostalism or biblical Christianity alone can get you to where you need to be with God. It is not about being saved by an outside source. It's about taking responsibility for yourself as being a tiny little piece of the source. Like, I think of it like God is playing tag with itself, or is playing hide and seek with itself. Tag, you're it. Like, you're it. You're God trying to find your way back to God, because if you are this endlessly amazing creature that is all things and is omniscient and omnipresent, well, it might be kind of boring. So the one thing that you would do in endless creativity is experience all things. And the only way to do that is to split yourself up into trillions and trillions and quadrillions of little pieces and bring yourself back to yourself. And in my psychedelic experiences, lo and behold, nothing is sitting still. Everything is constantly recreating itself, self-transforming machine elves, as
Terrence
McKenna talked about them.
Well, yeah, and so you said when you went over there and had your experience, there were these other beings there waiting for you. And those, you know, he, of course, describes those as the self-transforming machine elves. And do you think then that in order for people to get back to that source and part of them, what do you think is that? Do you think that the DMT, the drugs, are like what we have to do, or is that just for you personally? That's what kind of like pushed it over the edge.
I don't think that DMT or ayahuasca is a panacea. I don't think that it is the cure-all. However, we are in such a bad way, culturally speaking, that psychedelics are one thing that stand alone as a cultural reset button. You can change your paradigm in 15 minutes. I mean, it's that powerful. And because of that, it has merit and it has worth. And I think that if people can find a legal time and place and way in which they can approach it in a very spiritual setting, that would be the ideal time for them to try. If not, there are excellent books that can teach you about shamanism, about owning your own personal responsibility and your own place in the universe and your ability to create that you can pick up on. There's an excellent book called Psychedelic Shamanism by Jim DeCorn. And in it, he's talking about psychedelics. And then the second half of the book, he's like, you don't need this stuff, though.
Yeah.
You can do this a whole other way. And,
exactly.
And I think that's what's missing, is that we're in an instant gratification culture.
And so that kind of brings us back to what I was talking about at the beginning of the show, is how there are these shifts kind of occurring all over the place, you know, and it's happening on pretty epic levels. So even though we are currently in this cultural paradigm of everyone needing it like immediately and everyone's got to have it right away or they won't like, you know, do the work because we're just stuck or whatever. So like how can you like kind of say how your personal experience with making a paradigm shift, have you seen like correlations to other people going through it and have you felt part of something in terms of that, or do you still feel like a little ostracized?
Well, I absolutely feel like the sequence of events were the sequence of events needed to occur in my life in order for me to get to where I'm trying to go or where I'm meant to go, however you might look at it. I have seen more miracles in my life, more amazing changes in people, because I was bold enough to do what I did. Scary and horrible. I felt horrible. Christianity. I felt horrible. Like pain that I went through emotionally. What if I'm screwing everything up?
Right.
What's going to go on with the rest of the world? It remained true to what my heart was telling me. Yep. I felt, as others might describe, when I started feeling remorse for what other people thought, things changes began to occur. It's how when you throw yourself into the void, you gotta that it is actually a feather bed. Like that's where it is to be confident in creativity that you have. And now I have people write me all the time for my morning about how their life has changed, how there were pivotal that they've given the book to. Lives are changing for the better. People are taking soul for their own salvation. And this isn't because everyone is our teacher. Everything. I mean, from the Buddhist perspective, the universe in a single atom. And he said that one of the keys to enlightenment is to glean off of your cereal spoon in the morning. To pay attention to the people around you and realize all the emanations of the higher source. And that's everything. Best to convey that to other people in my room, and it's been working. People blowing my mind how much they are doing. Would never understand what I was going through. Oh my God, what do I do next? What do I do next? Thing is, I have always wanted to hear this coming to fruition in a way that I never end. Great miracles of life is that it's more exciting. I'm at now my life from the personal perspective of I to what I have going on and to continue and to humbly disseminate the information that is to be able to distill information because as you know. Reading really complicated and there's a lot to figure out. Develop systems and which system do I spend? That was really difficult, but I've just and I feel really great about it and I need to be bold enough to take responsibility for
well and that's really I feel like
of their own world.
Yeah, that's totally what it boils down to generally, and that's like in any revolution, it's people like trying to not just relinquish all power and authority to a single person, but to try to take responsibility. I mean, hopefully, right? But to try to like help, you know, have everybody be participating in part of it instead of just a dictator or a tyrant or a certain elite group of people. So the ability for everybody to try to take more responsible, I feel like, is really what it comes down to in any paradigm shift when you're taking responsibility for your own thoughts instead of being influenced. But we're almost out of time, Gabriel. If you'd like, I'd love if you could tell folks where they can find you. I know you're also an author on the Disinformation website. Do you have your own website where folks can find out more information about you and your books and what you do?
Sure. All kinds of cool stuff on birds.com. I also write, and people can find me there. I'm Googling my name, Gabriel D. Sorry.
Great. Well, thanks so much for joining us today again. Gabriel Roberts' book is called Born Again to Rebirth. And thanks so much for sharing your story and experience with us today, Gabriel.
Yeah.
This is Maz Adao for Expanding Mind. Thanks for joining us today. Keep your minds open.